Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Music Business Podcast presented by Hypebot.com. I'm your host, Kyle Boleyn. Today on the show, I am talking with Jim McDermott, who is a social media and content marketing strategist for artists. Jim has been involved in new media and digital music since 1993. During his career, Jim has developed successful grassroots and online marketing campaigns for the likes of Guns N' Roses, U2, Sheryl Crow, David Bowie, and many others. He has also worked for major labels like Sony Music, PolyGram, Warner Music, UMG, and Island Records. I'm going to be talking to Jim about music exclusives. These days, it seems like every music streaming company is fighting over exclusive content. They all want singles and albums from popular artists that no one else has. But the question is, do consumers care, and is this going to be a strategy that signs up more paying subscribers for companies? Make sure that you subscribe to Music Business Podcast in iTunes or your favorite podcast app. You can also follow the show and get the latest episodes on SoundCloud. Here is my interview with Jim McDermott. Recently, you argued in a blog post that exclusive music does not work. Apple and Tidal are placing huge bets on exclusive music. They believe that having songs that no one else has will get them paying subscribers. You wrote that the internet does not want anything to be exclusive. What is a music exclusive, and how are physical and digital exclusives different?
An exclusive would mean I've got a recording that nobody else has. So I can say, hey, if you want to hear the new Rihanna track, you know, I've got it. Nobody else has it. So if I'm Spotify and I can say, or if I'm iTunes or whoever, or Beats or Tidal, and I've got this and nobody else does, then that's kind of a cool thing to be able to say to people. If you get a critical mass of exclusives, where you can say, hey, I've got stuff that nobody else is going to have, so I'm really the place, you know, where you should hang out. The differences in between the physical and the digital world is, if you're talking about products, is that in the physical world, you know, like Record Store Day as a for example, when someone produces a certain amount of units of something physical, when it's done, when it's sold out, it's sold out. And then the value of that is only going to increase as more people want to get that than units that are available. So if I pressed 107 inches on orange vinyl of something, then the 101st person that wants to get it is going to have to go onto Discogs or wherever, and they're going to have to pay through the nose to get it. And that price is only going to go up probably over time. Whereas with exclusives on the internet, because you're talking about a non-physical thing and it's zeros and ones that can be duplicated endlessly by anybody, ripped, the window of the value of that exclusivity is really, really narrow. It goes the other way. It goes down the longer it exists, because the minute it comes out, somebody can just rip the audio, or they could rip the video and then re-upload it to YouTube or anywhere else. So saying that your exclusive has value in a digital world is kind of a fallacy. It's a nice thing to kind of say. It's a good thing to hang your marketing hat on. And traditionally, it's a way that retailers and or media platforms, like whether it's radio or MTV in the old days, or whether it's streaming stores or iTunes or whatever now, it's a bartering chip, and it's a kind of it's a way of doing business that everybody's been comfortable with for a long time. But especially in the streaming world, it just doesn't really work anymore.
As you're saying there, music stores and streaming services have offered exclusive releases for a long time. This is not exactly a new approach. It's been done. How does a music store or service get an exclusive?
Well, what happens is, like, when I worked at, let's say when I worked at Epic, we would have a meeting, and let's say Pearl Jam was coming out with a new record, and the first thing the new media department would do, we'd say, okay, well, how are we going to tell the world about the fact that this is coming out? What do I have to barter out to all my important players out there? So the product manager would say, oh, okay, well, I've got a couple of, you know, B-sides, or I've got a live track, or I've got the first single. And this same thing would happen in radio, you know, like basically – You might in a market, you might decide that you want everybody to have the record at the same time, or you might decide that somebody who's really supported the band or someone who's going to make a big marketing impact, it would be better to give it to them first before anybody else. So first thing is, you have to establish what assets you have to work with, and then you take that pool of assets and maybe it's a few songs, maybe it's some B-sides, maybe it's some live tracks, and you say, I'm going to spread these around. So I have, and you're essentially bartering those exclusives for marketing visibility. So if you say to iTunes, like, everybody wants to be on the front, the main pane of iTunes. If you can say to iTunes, like, hey, I'll do a pre-sale with you, and anybody that buys the record from you, they're going to get a bonus track that isn't going to be available from anybody else. That's a pretty compelling reason for iTunes to say, okay, I'll put you on the main pane of my store if it's an important record. If it's not an important record, if it's just, you know, a developing artist that iTunes, that nobody at iTunes necessarily cares about, there's still going to maybe be, you know, a blog out there that's very important within a specific genre, and you might go and give it to them. I mean, you look at Pitchfork, they constantly, or even NPR, has full album streams available weeks before they're released commercially, and that's really, it's a marketing play. It's to get people to kind of listen to the record, and it's to get those players to feature it prominently. In the old physical retail days, we kind of did the same thing where, you know, you'd go to Best Buy and say, or Target or whoever, and say, I'm going to do a special version of this Madonna record with you. I'm going to put a remix that's only available on your CD. So if people want that, they're going to have to go to Target to buy actually that copy of the record. And then, okay, so Target, what are you going to do for me? And in the physical days, it would not only be marketing visibility, but it might be tied to how many physical units you ordered. So you might say, all right, I want Target, I want you to buy 20,000 copies of the new Madonna record. And maybe the buyer says, well, I only want to take 10. You go, all right, well, I'm going to give you advertising. I'm going to give you an exclusive track, blah, blah, blah. And then they go, all right, I'll take 20,000. So in the physical world, it was a little different because exclusives could also be used to bump up the initial orders on physical goods. But in the digital world, it's really about bartering just for marketing visibility and also keeping the overall relationship great, because you have to remember, if you give an exclusive to one guy, that means everybody else doesn't get it. And then those other people might be kind of pissed off that they didn't get it. So you got to think, well, what else do I have to give them to kind of pacify them or to make them happy so that they don't penalize me on other artists? And that's something that really I never see get brought up in the discussion about exclusives, is that when you give one thing to somebody and nobody else gets it, that doesn't make all those other people happy. So then they might penalize that artist in terms of how much they get behind the record. They might penalize the artists of that that the label has, other artists that are totally unrelated to this project, by deciding not to feature them as prominently as they would otherwise. So it's this kind of big game that gets played, and it's been played, well, it's been played as long as I have been in the record business, which is the mid-80s and counting.
My next question is, who pays for an exclusive release? Like, how does the money exchange hands? Is Apple paying labels? And are there other instances, well, where the labels might pay the provider, like Target or another retailer of that nature?
You know, in my experience in the digital world, it completely changed from the physical world. There really has not been money, in my experience, that's changed hands in regards to exclusives. Exclusives really are something that just gets bartered, and it isn't a case of saying to somebody like, "Oh, we have to pay you," you know, or Apple, "Hey, Warner Brothers, I'm going to pay you if you give me an exclusive session." Really, what you want is you want that visibility, because the more people that download that hear the record, the more people that download the record, the more money you make as a label, and that's your goal. Or the more streams you get, more revenue you get, that's the goal. So, you know, the exclusive thing, really, what you're concerned with is the expense in creating it. And these places like Spotify, if they have Spotify sessions, they have a studio. Now, when the artist comes into town, the publicist and the product manager are responsible for making sure that their days are filled to promote their record. So if it's like, okay, yeah, at 2 o'clock, we've got you over at Spotify, you're going to do an exclusive session with them. There may be, for certain kinds of thing, you know, for certain events, the streaming service or the download service might reimburse expenses for getting somebody somewhere or for putting something up. But it isn't a case of where somebody's buying exclusives. That's not really the way that it works. It's more of a barter thing. And what essentially these guys are doing is then they're creating master recordings of their own. Like, if you went to Spotify and you have Spotify exclusives, like, they don't actually really own that master because the recording company has the exclusive rights for that artist, but they've kind of been given permission to do the recording and to have the recording up on their website. I'm sure somewhere in the agreement it says that If the label ever decided to release it, maybe they would throw, maybe they'd throw Spotify a couple of dollars or give them some percentage of whatever the revenue was if they made it a commercial product. But it isn't really about money changing hands for exclusives. Exclusives in the digital world are more about marketing visibility and getting that kind of pop. And what are you, the content provider, meaning the label or the artist, is saying, what are you going to give me visibility-wise in exchange for me giving you this exclusive content? And then the content provider is saying, I'm going to record it, you know, you're going to come in, and then I'm going to put you on my homepage, you're going to send out an email to, you know, our 2 million subscribers, you're going to be in the lead of that email. I mean, this has been going on since the very early days of digital in music, where we had assets, we went out to various channels, I knew what their audience size was, and I would say, okay, here's an exclusive download, what are you going to give me, Yahoo? Got, you know, rest in peace, Dave Goldberg. But I'd say, what are you going to give me, Dave, if we give Launch an exclusive track from Fiona Apple? And they go, okay, well, we're doing newspaper advertisements, and we're going to send out emails to 300,000 subscribers, and you're going to be on the homepage, blah, blah, blah. And then I'd say, okay, that all sounds good. And then I would go and I would sit with the product manager and in a general label meeting, and I would say, here's all the visibility that we've got back with the assets. And then I would map eyeballs to all those assets. So I'd say, you know, you gave me 4 exclusive download tracks, and here's all the marketing programs and all the places where we're being featured. And the person we're marketing this with, the streaming service or download service, has given me these numbers of how many people see it if it's in that place for this amount of time. So I would then say, I'm bringing 10 million eyeballs to this record at, you know, in advance of the release. So that's kind of how you stack it up. You barter the assets, you understand what the value of that barter is in terms of how many people are going to see it and all the various platforms it's going to go out, all the marketing windows, whether it's social, email, website, on the service itself. And you calculate that and you just say, okay, for this one download track, I just got you 20 million impressions. And that's kind of how you measure the value of it. It isn't write me a check.
As I said earlier in the conversation, Apple and Tidal both want exclusive music. They want to be able to say that they have something that other services are not, whether that's the latest Taylor Swift single or an exclusive Jay-Z live performance. Why do Apple and Tidal want exclusive music? And can you talk about what the difference between the types of exclusives those services get might be?
Well, yeah, it's kind of interesting because Apple's been around for a long time and Jimmy Iovine knows everybody. So you have Apple, who's used to doing exclusives with people now since 2003. And then so you have a long embedded history of them getting stuff that nobody else has gotten. So it's deeply ingrained in their culture. They know how to do it. People know what the value of that is by giving it to iTunes. And then you layer Jimmy on top of it, who can just, you know, if a label doesn't want to do it, he'll just call their manager and anybody's going to say, oh, Jimmy's calling. Let's give that exclusive to Apple instead. So they've got a lot of power for the exclusives. Then on the other hand, you've got Tidal, which is artist owned. So you can have Jay-Z say to somebody like, if Madonna actually has ownership of Tidal, it's a very compelling argument to her to go like, look, why would you give it to Apple? Invest in yourself. Keep the exclusive here because, you know, the more people that view it here, that's more money in your pocket. Why would you, you know, why would you build up Apple? And that's going to be the argument. The argument's going to be a hard one because, you know, on one level, you've got a lot more ingrained audience and a long history of doing it correctly at Apple. So it's going to be very compelling to give the exclusives to Apple. They're going to be going after the same stuff. You don't think the Tidal and iTunes both want Beyonce and Rihanna and Daft Punk and Coldplay and Jack White exclusives? They're all going to want that. So they're going to be competing with each other. So the only thing Tidal, with their much smaller audience and gigantic mountain of unhipness to climb, have in their pocket is that they can say to the artists, like, invest in yourself and you'll get a return on that investment. Whereas with Apple, it's going to, you know, you're going to get so much less out of it in terms of actual real money, and you're not building equity in it. Because remember, when you give the thing is, you're not just giving an exclusive to Apple when you give Apple an exclusive, if you are somebody who has a piece of the company. You're developing the value of that company. And really what Tidal is, and I'm pardon me for being cynical, but Tidal isn't, I don't really think, isn't really about changing music. It isn't really about a revolution. What it is about these big artists saying, hey, our music has been licensed out and it's made all these people like Daniel Ek and all these other people, YouTube, blah, 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 rich, right? So we want to get rich. So let's create our own streaming service. Let's go out there, make it really successful. Let's go get a multi-billion dollar valuation and let's us get us our $300 million payday. That's what it's about. So the argument then isn't about how to market your record properly. The argument is, hey, Madonna, when you signed up for this, you said you were going to give exclusives because you, like the rest of us, want this to get a huge valuation so we can eventually get bought and you can get a multi-hundred million dollar payout. So if you don't give us those exclusives, you're not going to get that. And that's what an exclusive on Tidal is for the people who have equity in Tidal. For anybody else who doesn't have that level of equity in Tidal, it makes absolutely zero sense to give them an exclusive relative as opposed to iTunes because they just don't have the audience. And I don't think they're going to get the audience personally.
I think the biggest question to ask here is, do music consumers value music exclusives?
Yeah, they do. But I mean, it's in the context of what, you know, like we look at music consumers like, or it required to kind of like compare Apple versus Tidal in the context of exclusive. You have to like imagine that it's somebody sitting in front of a desk going, who should I subscribe to? Tidal with this new Rihanna thing I can't get anywhere, or Apple with this U2 album I can't get anywhere. But the reality is that's not how people think these days, especially younger people. They go, I can get all this stuff on YouTube anyway. I can stream way more exclusive content on YouTube than I can on any legal streaming service. You know, as an adult, I can watch, you know, who's into music from multiple decades. You know, I can watch BBC performances that clearly are not licensed to YouTube. I can watch, you know, from the 60s, 70s, 80s. I can watch old Grey Whistle Test stuff. I can listen to current full albums, you know, not only from big artists, but from very obscure stuff. Like I'll routinely be in a record store like, you know, I'll go out to Rough Trade or other music here in New York and I'll see a 12-inch that on an interesting label and I'll go, let me fire this up on Spotify. And it's not there. And then I go to SoundCloud and get it, or I go to YouTube and I get it and the whole record's there. And I don't pay anything for that. So the thing is, this debate about exclusives and what the value is takes place in this really non-realistic world, you know, where everybody is looking at vanilla or chocolate, you know, Tidal or Apple or Spotify, you know, vanilla, chocolate, strawberry. And the reality is that you can get it from a bazillion different places and you don't even have to pay for it most of the time. So anyway, I don't know if that actually answers the question, but to me, not to factor YouTube into the whole exclusive conversation, you know, it's kind of like, it's just a gigantic joke that, and I see so much stuff written about, you know, these new moves like Spotify is going to be licensing video content. You know, whoop-de-doo. Whatever Spotify licenses, I guarantee you it's probably already on YouTube, or I can already find it online and not have to pay for it. So in the world of VCs and people who are trying to build multi-billion dollar companies to get bought by other people, that kind of stuff matters because you're worried about share price. If you're worried about the music consumer, they're not thinking about any of this stuff. They're not comparing apples to oranges. They're just Googling or YouTubing or whatever. They're just searching on what they want and they're getting it. And if you don't have it, they'll just get it somewhere else. And if you have it, but it's nowhere else, one of their friends will grab it from you and then share it with everybody. That's the real world.
I think what's interesting about the battle over exclusives is that we have the potential to create this world just like Netflix and Hulu, where, you know, Netflix has a decent amount of content, but it's not overflowing with the latest hits per se. And the same thing goes with Hulu. It's got most of your TV shows you might want to watch, but plenty that aren't there. I feel like as music streaming services battle it out over getting exclusive music, we're going to end up in a world where services are lacking substantial amounts of catalog from popular artists because someone else was able to bid the other one out or negotiate some equity or whatever that partnership might look like. Meanwhile, consumers are just going to figure out where they can get that content for free, and they're not going to worry about whether it's on Spotify, Audio, Tidal, Apple, or NPR or wherever, quite frankly. So I feel like that music services are just shooting themselves in the face by getting into the exclusivity wars, because eventually they're not going to have everything that they want. And the whole appeal of a limited music for a monthly price is going to get marginalized and go down.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, the thing is, again, what is the motivation? You know, why does everybody go to that? Why is it a big argument? If you think about it, like, this should be a fairly mature industry by now. I mean, the first time I heard streaming music, a guy named Mika, whose last name I can't remember, from Real Networks came and showed me, you know, online audio and video, like Real Networks, like 1.0 or something like that, or Real Player 1.0, like in 96, 97, you know, and here we are 20 years later. And all that we're talking about with these services, like, the big innovation is, oh, we're going to have stuff the other guy doesn't have. 20 years later, that's the conversation. Like, nobody still can make money. Everybody's losing tons of money, but that's the answer to the question. So the thing is that, are they really trying to create a business and really serve the music consumer? Or are they just doing something because they're trying to keep, you know, a stock price high and a perception of value for their company high? And these things are kind of like stripes. You go, oh, we got this. And, you know, it makes for great news articles. It makes for great stories in the media. But at the end of the day, does the consumer really care? And I think the answer is that some of them care for a minute, but that period of time is so short because nothing on the internet wants to be exclusive. You know, they want to be ubiquitous. So the people who are saying that this is the play are either completely clueless about the true nature of the internet, which you got to believe they're not, because especially at Apple, you can't really say those guys are clueless about it. So they're either clueless about it, or they're willfully kind of pursuing a different strategy because maybe the end goal isn't really to make consumers happy. Maybe they want to make it into something that's the minimum price possible and make it so it's just really dumbed down and just really easy to do. I don't know. But it surprises me that literally 20 years later, this is the conversation. You have Apple and Tidal and Spotify. Like, Spotify has a valuation that's like greater. I mean, really, what did Spotify create? Not to bag on them too much, but what did they create? It's an online jukebox. There's nothing interesting about the interface. There's nothing interesting about the underlying technology. They have none of their own masters. All they did was create an interface. And I've looked at hundreds of those interfaces since the 90s. And Spotify, I don't look at it ever and say, wow, that's interesting. There's nothing interesting and nothing unique about what they do, period, except maybe give people a free tier. That's it, right? So, yet it's worth, what's the latest valuation of Spotify? $8 billion or something like that? And you have companies that have created, that have master catalogs of music that's going to be exploitable for potentially hundreds or maybe thousands of years that are worth less than that. And that's just really kind of insane to me. So the thing is, the whole conversation really, it really isn't about the value of music. It really isn't about how to make a better experience for the consumer. It's about how to make a very select group of people richer than they already are and give the artists really almost nothing in that. I mean, to a degree, I mean, the one positive about Tidal, and it's hard to find a positive in Tidal, but the one positive about Tidal is that at least they're thinking about giving the artists some equity in it. But then you look at who they're going to give the equity to, and it's people who don't really need it, you know? I don't think that Jay-Z or Madonna or Beyonce or Nicki Minaj really need, or the guy from Maroon 5, who you see in every single Target advertisement. I don't really think those guys are trying to like scrape money together to buy a guitar or pay their rent, you know?
So later in your blog post, you argue, as you are arguing now, that music services often try to differentiate themselves in boring and unimaginative ways. This is in part why Tidal and Apple are trying to get exclusive music. creating new and compelling features is hard. Negotiating deals for select releases is easy. How else are music services trying to differentiate themselves? And do you think these strategies work?
Well, I think, Jimmy, I mean, said something about, you know, I was watching an interview with him online. I can't remember who it was with, but he was talking about, you know, the internet hasn't done a good job of saying what's next. Like, it's really good in terms of, like, if you know what you want, you go somewhere and you press the button, you hear what you want, but you have to kind of already know that you want it. So he said that what they're going to launch is something that's going to be, you know, they're going to be really good at showing you what's next. And if you look, he signed a deal with some big DJ from the UK who's going to be doing curated playlists and, you know, maybe try to bring a little bit more of that content curation into the service, which is a good thing. But one could argue there's lots of playlists in all of these services. And there's almost just, it's almost like, you know, when you, it's kind of like the same argument with cable TV being like 500 or 600 channels. You know, when you had four channels or five channels, or on your, or you're driving around in your radio and you're driving home from work in the afternoon, you know, like there's one or two stations that play your kind of music. You press the button and go back between one or the other and you find what you like, and it's pretty easy. But when you've got endless dozens and dozens and dozens of playlists and all this content that you're being barraged with, it's almost like there needs to be a less is more kind of a thing. So it'll be interesting to see whether or not Beats is able to take this tremendous amount of content and then look at individual users and say, I think you, Jim McDermott or Kyle, will like this thing. That it's that would be interesting because they have all this data from us about what we've bought. So you would think Spotify, all this data about what we listen to, when we listen to it, you know, all this data. And it seems like nobody's doing anything with it. So if it's just some UK DJ who has like a playlist on the homepage that says, here's the hottest new dance tracks, that's nothing really new. So it'll be interesting to see whether or not they actually take content curation to this, to the next level, and kind of intersect it with all the data they have of our behavior over the past decade from what we've bought from them and actually make it something compelling. My instinct is that it's not going to blow my socks off when it launches.
What I've realized in recent years is that most people never see any of the music services that we talk about. So Songza is the service that arguably brought this idea of music concierge, the right kind of music for the right time of day, to the music business, and potentially millions of users, tens of millions of users, but certainly not hundreds of millions. And Beats Music would be lying if they said they weren't inspired by what Songza did, because everyone else in the music streaming space certainly ripped them off instantly. So when I think about the idea of Apple bringing these curated mixes to the music app in over 800 million iOS devices, what I see is your mom seeing that there's a workout playlist and going, oh, that's interesting. I never really thought of that before. I'm going to click on the workout playlist and see if this makes sitting on the elliptical more fun. So I agree that what they're doing isn't going to be that innovative. And I agree that it's probably even not that interesting. But the reality is that there's millions of people who have not been exposed to these ideas before, who might be pleasantly delighted by this curation offering that DJ Zane Lowe and Jimmy Iovine have put together for Apple.
Yeah, but, and I just say this because before I ever got into technology, I spent time in artist development. The kind of like music guy in me says, all right, well, what is the workout playlist? Because a workout playlist for a 15-year-old girl or 16-year-old girl is different than a workout playlist for a 25-year-old or 30-year-old guy, is different than a workout playlist from a mom who's 50 or a woman who's recovering from a pregnancy, or a guy who's coming back from, you know, a serviceman who's coming back from overseas and is dealing with PTSD, or, you know, blah, 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 blah. In other words, like, what's the intelligence behind the playlist? Because I'll tell you something. If I work out, I don't want to listen to Rihanna. When I work out, I don't want to listen to Katy Perry fireworks. And that's the problem, you know, is that all of these kind of playlist kind of metaphors Because again, it's not like Jimmy needed to show up at Beats and bring it to iTunes for playlists to be a thing. Playlists have been a thing for a long time. And we've all had this kind of idea of like, oh, it was going to be this kind of mixtape metaphor, you know? And the thing about why did a mixtape work, which essentially was a playlist, like back in the day when you actually made somebody a tape, like let's say you were obsessed with a girl and you made her a mixtape. Well, it's because you knew something really about her and you had emotions about her and you might think how she thought about you, and then you have music that you connect all that to, and then you create something that's really personalized and really has a lot of emotional content. Tell me how DJ Zane Lowe is going to do that for my 70-year-old mom when she feels like she needs to do some power walking. The thing is that these ideas, I'm very skeptical about what those guys are going to do with Beats, because everybody forgets that what preceded Beats was Mog, and what preceded Mog being a music service was Mog being a music blog. And I was very heavily involved in that from the beginning of it as one of their, you know, first users, and did a tremendous amount of blogging on that site. And I thought, oh, cool. Now we're going to be able to like write about stuff and have music like woven into it. So we're going to be bringing, you know, that emotional content and that person, you know, that person to person, like, why does this matter to me? And here's all this passion, and then you can listen to it right there. So I'm telling you how great it is, and now you're going to be able to hear it while you're reading about why I say it's great, right? And then they killed all that as soon as they took it over, right? And somehow they turned a service that David Hyman and the people at Mog like had spent years building and sold. They bought it from those guys for, I don't know, $14 million. And sometimes the Beats guys threw some headphones into the mix, and suddenly it's worth billions of dollars, and it's going to be the thing that saves music. I'm a little skeptical about that personally, but, you know, to me, having been involved in digital music, like from the very beginning, when I was at Polygram and when it came to us, kind of like new media, new technology in music came to us through the CD-ROM and the Blue Book spec, which was like, okay, well, the next CD is going to have this session on it where you can have all this multimedia. And so it's going to be, and, you know, we had this package that was really boring relative to an LP because it was so small. And now we're going to be able to do stuff that's even better than an LP, all this great visual stuff, and people can really get into the creative process of the record, and it was going to be amazing. And so to me, the promise of multimedia, you know, coming out of the 80s and looking to think what people like Laurie Anderson did with it, was like, or David Byrne, was like, wow, that's going to be what everything is. It's all going to be color and visuals, and it's going to be so rich, you know? And so here we are 20 years later talking about playlists for your mom while she works out, man. And call me a digital hippie, but that is just such a boring bummer that that's all that it is. It's really a drag to me.
So what do you think that it could be?
Well, I think that you have to look at what is happening in what's changed really, you know, because music has always been something that is kind of, it's cyclical, and it is redoubled its importance through what's happened in society, right? It's been a reflection of, and it's been driven by what's happened in society. And what has happened in society over the past, let's say 10 years, all, you know, everything that's happened in social networking and everybody producing content and everybody being so much more connected, and everybody serving up all this intensely personal data, like millions potentially of data points, right, that we're providing to these people, and then they're turning into billionaires because of it, right? And they're doing really stupid stuff with all that data. Like, you know, Facebook sees that I read a story about a motorcycle, and then like they serve me ads for the next 3 months on motorcycles. Like, that's really all they're doing with all this stuff that I've shared with them. Or Spotify, you know, they've seen everything I've listened to for the past 5 years, and they're still telling me about the new Chris Rock, Jesus, what's the name of the guy that beat up Rihanna?
Chris Brown.
or should I say, what's the name of the young man with the young R&B artist? Chris Brown. Yeah, they're still trying to make, you know, they're still telling me a new Chris Brown record is coming out. I've never listened to Chris Brown the entire time I've been on Spotify, not 10 seconds of it, yet they have to tell me it's coming out, right? So the thing is, they have all this data. They've used it to generate these huge fortunes, and all this money for venture capitalists. There's billions of dollars out there. And what are they doing? they're serving us up little custom ads on stuff they think we want to buy. And they're not putting that investment back into making these services really compelling. And to me, if you take all these data points, like if I had all, when I was making mixtapes for some girl that I liked when I was in my 20s and I had as many data points on her as Facebook probably does on any person on their service now, I could make her like, I could make her mixtape that would make her want to marry me, you know, like probably. So where I think it should go or it could go is, because I really think we're not in music 2.0 yet. I think we're in music 1.5. And why? Because we're doing stupid things like talking about exclusives 20 years later. That's why, that's why I believe that. When I think we get to music 2.0 is when we take all this rich data and all this social interaction and all this location-based stuff, and we say, I'm going to present you with a service that is next level, that provides you an experience that isn't just about cheap, lots of cheap music and the occasional thing you can't get anywhere else. That to me is really short-sighted and easy. Evolving it to the next level and taking all of this data that really all they're doing is using it to make them, to enrich themselves further, and actually saying, you have a responsibility with my data to provide me a better service. And I've given you so much of this data. So do that. Make a compelling service that really looks at who I am, what I like, when I listen to it, what my habits are, where I'm traveling, what my environment is, and make it important to me again. You know, don't make it like, well, yeah, well, maybe we could sell it for $6.99. Oh, well, then somebody else is going to go, well, you know, if it was $2.99, well, what if it was just free? What if we just buy a phone and all the music in the world was free? And then there's a couple of guys at the top who are multi-billionaires, and there's a bunch of artists going, hey, I'm poor and I can't make records anymore. Like, how about instead of doing that again, we take all of this data and all this richness and we actually make an experience that makes people go, wow, this is better than it ever was. This is better than the 60s. You know, this is better than when music was in its supposed glory day, heyday. This is something that's enriching my life to a degree that I never even imagined. That's what I would like to see personally.
I really hope that in 20 years, I don't listen back to this podcast and cry, we're not even in music 2.0 yet. Everything Jim says is still true.
Well, you know, honestly, For a lot of people working in digital music, they think everything started with iTunes, and they weren't there for the 10 years that preceded that to see kind of what the promise of it was and the lessons of that, and then see, okay, well, now here's the past 10 years. Now let's take the whole 20 years, at let's say roughly 22 years of the history of digital music, and say, where are we at? What's our report card? Where are we? And really, where are we? You have jukebox type interfaces where people can click and hear most anything that's licensable in their given territory for the low price of $10 a month. It just sounds like, what are we selling, cars or carpet or where's the excitement in that? You know? So, I mean, from the standpoint of it's a business and we're making money from it, and if that's all it is, you know, then I guess there's something to be excited about it there. I'm sure that VCs are excited about it because, you know, when Spotify has something like an $8 billion valuation, that's all they care about. For me, as somebody who's been in the music business my whole life, I go, what did they create? This is just complete hype. There's no there. The emperor has no clothes. You know, their next big idea is, oh, because Apple's going to be big, we better license video content. That's it. Really? It's just boring.
Can you talk about their next big idea, how Spotify is going to bring video into the service and what that might mean for the next couple of years in their product roadmap?
You know, I mean, I guess, you know, it's just more content and it'll be back to more exclusives and they'll be competing with each other. But I don't know to what degree any of these people are sitting down and thinking about what the consumer wants. I think that they're thinking about what they're going to do in order to keep the valuation high so that everybody at the top of that food chain can get a big payday, or, you know, or can keep whatever big payday they've had. And I you know, honestly, will it be a good thing for consumers? I mean, if I have Spotify, they're not going to be able to offer me video at the same price point. So there's probably going to be, I'm assuming, some kind of uptick for the video content. And I think that licensing video, because this from the TV studios and the networks, they're no pushovers. So I don't think that anybody's going to get it for free. So, you know, what does Spotify want to be? They want to be make it so that you don't have to go to Netflix. You just have Spotify, and that has audio and video. And I guess that's on some level interesting. I mean, really, consolidation is the way these things go. Remember, there used to be, what, 9 majors or something like that? And what are there now, 4? You know, there used to be endless amounts of radio stations. There used to be endless amounts of music magazines. The nature of all this stuff is that it's going to consolidate. So what'll there be? 2 or 3 big players? And Spotify will end up, you know, getting bought by somebody. I mean, look, AOL and Huffington Post, they just got acquired by Verizon. Maybe somebody like that will end up buying, you know, Spotify or Pandora or whatever, and there'll be a couple of different services, and that's it. But they're all doing, for the most part, kind of the same thing. So I don't know. It's all very breakfast cereal to me. You know, it's like, okay, yeah, whatever. Like, you know, it's nothing really that exciting or different. It's not like I'm going to go, ooh, I can get video on Spotify now. No, you know what? I have Apple TV. I can get Netflix. Amazon Prime gives me a ton of stuff that I never watch. You know, it's not, you know, it's just kind of whatever. Again, maybe I'm a little bit too cynical about it, but I really think that these things, the reason I'm saying it's whatever is because, you know, if you layer video into Spotify, I guess that's a really exciting thing to people who are looking at the stock and who are thinking about how much it's worth and who are thinking about whether or not it's going to be acquired. But for the average person on the street, it's like, yeah, okay, yeah, I can watch my video on Spotify. Well, I can already watch it in Netflix, you know, and I just have to get in a shot at the Apple Watch, you know? I think it's kind of like the Apple Watch is a product without a purpose, right? I picked one up and I said, well, I can, okay, so all the stuff my phone can do, I can do a dumbed down version of it on my wrist, you know, so I don't have to take the phone out of my pocket. And that's what Apple's kind of sunk to. It's like, you know, we're not going to really release a product that's truly innovative. We're just going to make something that if you're so lazy you can't take your phone out of your pocket, this is a value add. And then there will be people on, you know, and is it because they're trying to please consumers or please themselves, or is it because they're trying to please people who are saying what Apple's valuation is? I don't know. I just don't know whether or not these decisions are really consumer driven. I think that they're about pleasing a very select bunch of people who are kind of controlling billions and billions of dollars and the perception of whether or not a company is worth that.
So Community got canceled. They got picked up by Yahoo. The Mindy Project got canceled. It might go to Hulu. American Idol just got canceled. Could it go to Spotify? If Empire doesn't get renewed, could it go to Spotify?
I guess the thing is that you've got to, on some level, you know, what's interesting about the landscape changing on that level is Spotify is, for the most part, as much as they do have exclusives and they have, you know, their Spotify sessions thing, they're not really content creators, right? They're content licensors, they're content distributors, they're a distribution platform. So then you get into, all right, well, then what does that mean? Is basically the Mindy Project going to be, you know, have an independent production company and they just license it out to somebody like that? Or is Spotify really going to get into the content production business in a big way? I mean, it's an interesting question. They could. It certainly seems like that's, you know, an emerging option. I mean, I certainly don't know enough about the TV industry and how that works to say, you know, because I spent my life pretty much in the music business. I haven't really spent enough time in the, you know, dealing with TV to make a really good, you know, insightful comment about it. But I do know that when, as it applies to music, when you start making records with people and having to deal with the human aspects of that, like some of the best artists have problems, you know, that you have to get them through. And you know, I can remember being in multiple situations where we were at a label and somebody had serious issues, and whether it was a label president or an A&R person or whatever, was like dealing with somebody who had substance abuse issues or mental health issues or, you know, or were just difficult people or had a lot of self-doubt or whatever. And there was a lot of nurturing that took place there. And then you also had people who knew how to extract the best from those people in whatever circumstance that they were in. And it's a very rare skill that true artists have. And it's also a rare skill to find people that know how to extract that from them. I recognize when it's something of value, recognize what it's going to take to get it from something maybe abstract or remove the self-doubt and turn it into a work of genius. And the guys at Spotify are not that, you know? With respect to Apple, you know, like the creating content, really extracting the best from artists. It's one thing to distribute content and say, hey, you can put 20,000 songs on this little gadget, or here's this real fun interface, or here's how you sync all this stuff up. It's a very different thing to actually, in music, to actually find something that has potential, extract that potential, and make it into something that people care about, and then actually expose it to people who and help them find it. You know, that's a very different challenge. And I don't have a lot of optimism that people in the, you know, people who essentially are distribution plays, who are you know, who really don't know how to make money, you know, off of what they're distributing, but yet somehow have these huge valuations. I really don't have confidence that these people are going to be nurturers of content. I think that they're going to throw stuff out there and try to make it as cheap as possible and try to extract as much money as they can for themselves out of the opportunity.
Well, I think that's one note to end the show on tonight.
I know I'm being so dark, you know, I'm sorry. I shouldn't be so cynical about stuff, but I really do hope that, I hope that I'm wrong, but if you look back at 20 years and the fact that we're you know, the big conversation is exclusives, it's hard not to be a little cynical about where things are going.
So, Jim, if people want to look you up online and learn more about the services that you offer, where can they find you?
They can go to my website, which is trickness.com, TRICKNESS.com, or follow me on Twitter at TheTrickness. And, you know, I'll just say that if an artist or anybody out there, you know, wants to ask me a question about something they're looking at or something they don't understand in the digital space, if it's an interesting question, I'd love to have, you know, the dialogue on Twitter or on the blog about it. If it's, hey, here's my demo tape, get me signed, there's probably better places to do that.
Thank you so much for coming on the show tonight.
Cool. Thanks, Scott.
That's all for this episode of the Music Business Podcast. Thanks to Hypebot.com for helping to put this podcast out. If you have any questions or comments, please email me at kyle.bylin@gmail.com. That's kyle.bylin@gmail.com. I'd love to hear from you, quite honestly.